This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. This week, we are going to travel to Adelaide, Australia, where we get a chance to visit with Raymond Crowe, who was traveling with The Illusionists. He's also been on several television shows like David Letterman's Late Night. He has been on Australia's Got Talent, America's Got Talent, has performed on several other television shows you may have seen. Anyhow, I'm going to give all of his credentials a little bit later, so I don't want to recount everything here. But I will tell you that some of the things we talk about here this week has to do with how that he got involved as being a mime. Using not language, but basically his body and his eyes and his head and his movements in order to emote emotions from the stage. He's just amazing at doing that. And one of the things that has made Raymond Crowe particularly famous is not only his creativity, which, by the way, he has received a creativity fellowship from the Academy of Magical Arts, the Magic Castle, but also he is well known for his hand shadow act. He has traveled all over the world and even has caught the attention of royalty and has given a royal command performance for Queen Elizabeth. It's amazing. He continues to just take the world by storm. He's been around for a long number of years, and I don't know if you've actually heard an extended conversation with him, but you do get to do that here this week. So please join me in welcoming my guest, Mr. Raymond Crowe, here on The Magic Word.
Good morning.
Today, we are going to be going down under, I guess you might say, in which we're going to be actually speaking with Raymond Crowe in Australia. He has appeared in The Illusionists. He's also been on the Royal Variety Show. He has won the Mandrake Award. He's been on the World's Greatest Magic in the United States on NBC. He has appeared also on the Late Night with David Letterman some years ago. And has also been not only on Australia's Got Talent, but also was an invited guest for America's Got Talent. He, of course, with The Illusionists, has appeared there in the Sydney Opera House, which probably is not too far from where he is. He has won the Creative Fellowship from the Academy of Magical Arts. He has been an invited performer and lecturer in FISM. His name is actually on the Walk of Fame. And he has appeared in Portugal then with Luis de Matos. And so my point is, I just want you to know about the international acclaim that my guest here has today. He is wonderful, and I spoke with him briefly when we were in Blackpool earlier this year after he had given an amazing lecture, and I enjoyed that, and so I invited him to come on and speak for a little bit longer. So please welcome my friend here today, Raymond Crowe. Hey, Ray, how are you?
Very good, Scott. Wow, I've never heard all that before, what you said.
Well, I hope that you can live up to all that.
Oh, I don't know.
When you stop and think about the immensity of, the, you know, over a period of time, it's like, you know, you're just kind of working along. Before long, gosh, you got a lot of things, you know, you can eventually live long enough. And I forgot to mention, of course, about the shadowography that you do then as well, which is another whole thing. There are so many different areas that I would like to get into, and I do think that eventually during the time of our discussion, we will get to. But one of the things I remember that Mr. Electric, Marvin Roy, had said that if you have a good silent act, you can work anywhere in the world. And that's something that you really have developed and honed to a perfection. I particularly like the idea that you had done with the zombie and the floating coat and the boa. And you had a wonderful lecture again in Blackpool and talking about the importance of how that you can emote with just a look in your smile in your face, and even all of the pictures that you're in, you can see that genuine affection, I guess, and you can see your spirit, your soul, I think, in the photos even that you take. So it's not just on stage. It seems like that you're always that way.
Oh, well, that sounds more impressive than what I am. I think when we talked before, Adelaide is where I live, in Adelaide, South Australia.
Okay.
And although we have a major festival here of arts and a fringe festival each year, which now has many magicians coming, like we just finished a couple of weeks ago here, the Adelaide Fringe Festival, and I think there was something like 20-something magic shows in there.
Is that the one that Tim Ellis is involved with? also?
No. This is more like the Edinburgh Fringe Festival.
Oh, the Fringe Festival in Edinburgh, sure.
Yeah, it's the largest fringe festival in the Southern Hemisphere. It's wow. massive for about 2 months. Anyway, but when I was growing up, it was very hard to see magicians. They only on TV when they'd turn up. And so I think in some ways it was a little bit of an advantage to sort of pursue your own way, I guess, because I wasn't able to see magicians all the time,
mm-hmm.
Unlike now we can see them 24/7.
Well, they weren't on TV, I guess, so much back then. I mean, like, of course, you, I guess, saw Doug Henning. I guess that went international.
Yes.
And
mm-hmm. Yes, Doug Henning shows were available.
They came through
David Copperfield and also the David Nixon show. There was some English magic shows mm-hmm. that would have been shown. And my favorite all time was a version of FISM, I think from 1971 or 73. Was a TV special that used to turn up on Sunday afternoons here in Australia on TV. And that's where I got to see Fred Capps and Richard Ross and Ricky Jay, a very young Ricky Jay. So they were my major magic influences when I was little, when I was younger, that I could see.
And so that really inspired you then to do more sleight of hand or stage or what?
Oh yeah. I really liked the idea of manipulation when I was younger.
Okay.
But I also was brought up on Abbott and Costello movies and Fred Astaire movies, I guess, mm-hmm. From the 30s and that. They were always shown on, again, Sunday afternoons or something here in Australia. And so a lot of my work, pretty much you can trace back to that sort of origin, I think, from those early films that I would have seen. I just like variety theatre. Mm-hmm. And I like variety theatre from, I guess, if I was to choose, from the mid-60s back, I guess. That's my favourite time period.
But physical comedy is something that you like a lot also then?
Yeah. I studied mime with a wonderful teacher here in Adelaide, Madame Zora Semborova, and she kind of introduced me or made me aware more of Charlie Chaplin. And so a lot of my work, you can see echoes of Chaplin, certainly in some of the body movements. I used to try to avoid doing them, but then I went, it's so much a part of me now. Why not embrace any echoes you have of other performers? They become part of you eventually. Yeah.
And so do you have a whole show or just a vignette that you do of Charlie Chaplin?
No, I only ever did a Chaplin show once with the symphony orchestra here. We got for a Christmas show.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually on my Facebook page, some of it. We got Chaplin's original music.
Wow.
So we got to choreograph a piece. And that was the only time I really did like an impersonation of Chaplin. When I say I absorbed his movements, there are gestures and there are attitudes that I've absorbed because I've just watched so much of it, mm-hmm. I guess. Yeah. And that also relates to any other silent movie, whether it be Harold Lloyd, Harry Langdon, or beautiful Buster Keaton. I admire them all and have lifted elements of them to use in my own work. Yeah.
When you said that you had taken classes then from the lady, Zora was her name? I assume that she must have been inspired similarly by some of those earlier actors that passed that on to you.
Yeah, she was more interesting. She was an immigrant to Australia. She'd come to Australia on a holiday in 1968 when Czechoslovakia became communist, and she'd been quite outspoken, so she couldn't go home.
Mm.
But she'd been an expressionist dancer in Prague and in Czechoslovakia. She was the first person to dance the role of Juliet in the Prokofiev score of Romeo and Juliet. So she was like anything but vaudeville. She was a legitimate theatre.
Theatre, right.
So she had quite a hard time swallowing some of the people who would end up being more clown-like in her class, but she'd come to this country and realized that she'd been given a great opportunity. She was teaching at the university movement here. This is before I knew her, and wanted to give something back to the country. And she realized at that time there was nobody teaching mime in Australia. So she went to Paris, studied, because she was a movement expert. She picked it up very quickly and came back to impart it to Australian actors and students. And I ran into her in her retirement.
Hmm.
So I was a very fortunate man to find such a dedicated.
Met or worked with Marcel Marceau?
Only more so. Sorry, I don't know. She, just to give you an idea of this woman, how strict she was, uncompromising. When Marcel Marceau played in Adelaide, she went backstage and gave him notes, because he wasn't doing it right. And her attitude was, her attitude was, who will tell him? He's a big star. Nobody will tell him.
Right.
And she didn't believe in big stars. She just believed in doing good work. So
I wonder how that interaction went. I would think he would have been taken aback.
Probably not well.
Yeah.
Probably not well.
Since he hadn't had anybody tell him anything different before.
Well, probably, but who, you know, but that's the type of person she was.
Right.
If she was honest in that regard, that if you don't know, you should be told.
You spoke about her briefly during your, at some length, actually, in your lecture there at Blackpool. And for some people who may not have heard that, can you kind of recount at least some of the highlights on that?
Oh, well, she had, when I met her, I was only 18. And I'd seen some magicians in Australia using whiteface at that time. And I'd never seen a mime artist. But I thought, I asked somebody, why are they wearing the whiteface? They said, oh, that's mime. And I thought I should learn it. So I literally opened the newspaper and there was an advert for the Australian Mime Theatre. And I was working full time fixing telephone answering machines and photocopiers at that point.
Hmm.
And I thought, I should learn another skill. That's what Daryl Fitzke says, and things like that. So I thought, okay, well, I'll learn another skill. And sorry, I should have said Henning Nelms. Henning Nelms is where probably mm-hmm. right there. And he and I rang her up, and I sort of made an indication that I may not be able to afford the time, and she let loose at me, telling me that children in her country work from 5 o'clock in the morning till 10 o'clock at night. And these lazy Australians couldn't even do 4 hours a week. And so I guiltily I went along. But she changed my life and all my work, everything I do, from hand shadows through to any of the magic that anybody seen me do, all encompass the techniques that she imparted to me.
And so she's part of you and also your thinking, I guess, and development of your routine.
Yeah. Yes, if you met any of her students, they all do an impersonation of her, but all with love and kindness, because mm-hmm. she was so strict, and you don't normally meet those people anymore.
Is there a group of people who were her students that you get together with from time to time?
No, the only other one I'm really in contact was as another wonderful mime here in Australia called Glyn Nicholas. He became quite famous in the 80s here. And he was wise enough to employ Madame, as we called her, to come and help direct some of the mime pieces in his work, as indeed I always encouraged her to have a look at my work and pull it apart. And we wouldn't necessarily always use what she said, but she was always made you think about things, how they could be clearer, or as she said, you know, things should always have a surprise in them. You know, there should... Nothing should be expected. It should be a surprise. There should be a surprise in every moment.
So it sounds like that she, in a way, was teaching magic, because that's what magic is about.
Very much so. And that's why in my lecture, and because we saw Paul Romani do his lecture about Chaplin.
Yes.
In my lecture, I say, you know, if you study those early Chaplin films, and I particularly say Chaplin because it's the beginning of film. In your country,
yes,
really in the world. And Chaplin is before Buster Keaton, and he's before Harold Lloyd.
Mm-hmm.
He's direct from musical, direct from vaudeville, and he's approaching film in those early films just like a vaudeville act, He enters the scene. He does something. There's interaction, a conflict, and he has to leave the scene because that's how they used to edit it. Person comes in from this side, he goes out that side, so they could cut them together. And as you watch him, you realize, A, that yes, he was a genius because he's the first clown in history that can see himself, which is pretty remarkable. And he was smart enough, you know, and he used writers as well. You don't really hear it, but there were certainly writers there helping. You get to see his construction of his gags. You know, there's surprises. There's always a surprise in that space. And then when you get along with Buster Keaton, you know, films have been being made for a while now and they understand the language a bit more. And Keaton is wonderful with surprises. Things are never what you think they are, you know. So I think for magicians to look at those, you can learn a great deal about construction and surprise. It's all, I see them very similar.
From start to finish, actually, that you can tell a whole story without actually using words.
Yeah, and just the structure, that they're using. A lot of it, you can, if you look at Charlie Fry, that's a great example. Charlie Fry studied all these as well, you know, and he understands, you know, structure and surprise and construction, you know, and that's something that acts need to know. I mean, some people are naturals, of course, but I think in our world, we're not encouraged in the magic world to seek out writers or directors, and I think that's a great loss for our art because your work can improve so fast. You know,
would that be a suggestion that you would make if someone was wanting to compete for FISM? In other words, you're competing on an international scale, basically. And what would you say to somebody as far as trying to develop an act?
Oh, I would say, yeah, I would. I always encourage people, if you're going to use a magician to help direct your act, I would only use them to direct the magic elements,
right?
Not the performance. Because there are some who certainly could do it, but we're more interested in the secrets and whether you can see it in your hand or not. But a director or a choreographer is interested in the structure, in the look, the shape of the act. And although a director won't add content to your work, they'll clarify it and they'll just say things like, why do you have your table on that side? Oh, I always have it on this side. And they just might say, well, if it's on that side, those people can't see you.
Right.
You know, and so acts can be improved very, very quickly. And that's why with, you know, in your country with Charlie Fry, people should be beating his door down to get him to look at their act.
Yeah, I've often said he's the new Johnny Thompson. He's someone, I believe, who knows it all. He's very humble about it.
Oh yes, he's humble, but because he's so well versed, you know, I can't sing his praises high enough. I think he's the likes of him we will never see again, because he is alluding to the past in many ways.
With the theatrical director, I guess you could find someone if you are near a university or even high school. Find someone, I think, who is out, as you suggest, then, Ray, I think if you have someone who is outside of our magic community, if you will, who is looking at it from a theatrical standpoint, can give you those kinds of points and tips. And so I think it's important that you do have someone who gives you another viewpoint. I mean, you can record it, then watch yourself later. You can do it in the mirror, but there are so many different things that you are trying to do. I learned a long time ago from Mark Kalin about how that even if you think you can do everything and you might be able to do things well, but you can't do it efficiently, you need to let other people who specialize in publicity, in theatrics, in choreography and music, let them do what they do and pay them for their skills. That will make you all the much better that you can devote your time then to making a more professional act and more cohesive.
Yeah, I 100%. I think of David Copperfield, you know, always had people helping him, you know, was always wise enough to do that. And it's just, if a lot of people are hungry for fame, I guess. I was never in a hurry. I just wanted to do good work. But if you are hungry for fame, then pay these people. that's their jobs.
Sure.
You know, and I found also, if there's a director that you admire or if you see a show, contact these people. A lot of people will help you, at least give you the time of day,
mm-hmm.
and put you onto some of them. They might have a student, they might have a friend who might be able to help if they can't. But I do find that that old saying, which again was one of my mind teachers, she told me, you know, always surround yourself with the best, they'll pull you up. And mediocrity will always try to hold you down. That was hard for me to hear when I was 18 because all your friends from school may not be the best people to be running around with anymore. But I've always found that professionals, usually if they're far enough ahead, they'll always offer some help
mm-hmm.
or some advice. Why wouldn't they?
If they're good friends, exactly. I mean, yeah. And they wouldn't have to be good friends.
Even strangers. Even strangers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because somebody helped them. And I think eventually you – and the help might just be get a director or, you know, or encouragement.
Right.
But always offer to pay. That's my other thing, is always offer to pay somebody.
That is true. I think there is a service that people offer, and a lot of times we don't give it the value that we think that it should have. So, yeah, you're right. I was talking with Mark Whitehouse, who plays Santa Claus, as I do during the holidays, and he was saying there are people who will go out and do Santa Claus for free. And he said that's a service that you can charge for, even though that you like doing it. And I think a lot of magicians are the exact same way. It's like, I just love to do magic, even if I'm not being paid, but you're doing a service and it has value. And so I think that you should be charging for it. And likewise, that there is value for someone who is a theatrical teacher or director or someone that or a choreographer or someone that can help you. And they might look at your show and give you a couple of pointers, but then I think it's important that you say, well, I want to pay you. How much is this going to be worth? So you just need to be prepared, I think, to pay if you want to go to that next level. And that's another thing. When you were talking about you didn't expect necessarily to achieve fame, and I think that if you're looking for fame and monetary success, you're probably not going to reach it if those are your goals necessarily. I think that comes as a result of doing the best job you can.
Yeah, I mean, it's I want to earn money. I've never, and I want to keep, I just, for me, it was always about just keep working.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it's the, and that's the biggest secret too for anybody starting out. Take every, when you're starting out, you probably aren't worth very much money.
Correct.
And so why not do those charity jobs? But just get out there. You really just have to keep, it's the hours in front of an audience and then asking people, what did you think of it? I mean, you know, it's sometimes very hard to hear, you know, and with magicians, because we're such a solo performer, we spend all those hours rehearsing, working on everything and micromanaging everything ourselves, as you said, it's sometimes very hard to give over to actually admit that somebody could be of help. But I've always found it a fast process. And I like to micromanage. I do everything, everything myself if I can. Mm-hmm. And it slows you up rather than speeds you up. What it does do is it does give you a lot of skills, of course. But you could be learning those skills from somebody else you're employing or working with. So I would just anybody at whatever stage of their career, bring somebody in.
Yeah.
For that moment. And also the good thing about buying a director, as I said in my lecture, is that you don't have to do what they say. You're paying for them. but they might just waken you to something you never considered.
Mm-hmm.
And they can see you on stage, who you are, because who we think we are and how the audience perceives us are usually quite different. And they can find your strengths.
I think whenever that you're saying, yes, that you should listen to what they're, you don't have to listen to what they're saying, or you don't have to follow their advice, but I think you need to be open to it and then think about it, sleep on it, and decide, are they giving you good advice? I mean, because a lot of times as a performer, and you have spent so much time working with your act, with one thing, and you feel like, okay, this is it. And then someone is saying, basically, your baby's ugly. You know what I mean? That they say, no, I don't care for this. And it's hard to hear that, but maybe it is. And you should just be open to it. Because I think there are some people who are just saying, no, I do it this way because, and they have lots of reasons or excuses as to why they're continuing to do that rather than listening to someone who is trying to give them some good advice that would steer them in the right direction. So I'm just saying, yes, you can reject that. But I think also before you reject anything, I think you should be open to it. And I'm sure that the higher up you get in a particular field of whatever that might be, you're going to have people who are going to come to you, as Madame Zora did, and going back to Marceau, and saying, you didn't do that right. So you're going to be having people all along your life, I'm sure, who are going to be saying, here's a suggestion. And the better they get to know you, that the closer they think that they are to you, they can give you some personal advice. And I'm sure you've had that happen too.
Yeah, don't surround yourself with yes men. You know,
have
some, of course. You need some. And that's the thing. I always thought with performing, I always thought, oh, I felt when I was younger, I felt less than the audience rather mm-hmm. than more than the audience, because I figured, well, they're the ones who actually are sitting in the entertainment, and I'm the one who feels like I have to stand up here in front of you and be clapped. Because certainly when you first start, that's a very attractive element of instant praise. And it's very seductive, you know, it still is. I still enjoy it. And when you do a good job and you get a nice response, that's job well done, you know. But eventually when it's your profession, then your attitude goes, yeah, okay, I got that one right. And because not every audience is the right audience for you. So, you know, eventually you come a cropper on something, you realize, oh dear, that wasn't my audience. But I think for me now, as I'm certainly entering another stage of my life, age-wise, mm-hmm. every performance seems to be, it was always important, but now it seems to be even more important to make sure that I've done the best I could for that group, because that's what they're paying me for.
And that's what they're going to remember. That's right. And you don't want to get to that point where you're that guy. It's like, oh, I heard he was good, or I remember him.
Yeah, I'm sure it happens to all of us eventually. And I guess you have to be prepared. One of my mentors was a man called Gene Raymond here in Australia, and Adelaide, in fact. He was a manipulator. And he made the decision when to retire. Mm-hmm. In fact, I did the last show with him here at the Festival Centre, which is like a big theatre complex here in Adelaide. And that was the last public show he did.
Hmm.
And he said, when I make a mistake and it's my fault, that's when I'll stop. So he stopped before that happened, which I think's
brilliant,
amazing.
Yeah.
But I think I'm going to be brave. I think they're going to have to
bring you off with the hook.
Yeah, bring me off with the hook. Yeah.
I want to touch on a few things that in your career, and going back to Charlie Chaplin for just a moment then too. I remember Paul Romani was talking about, I think he had met an heir of Charlie Chaplin's. And have you also?
No, I haven't. I've been to Chaplin's house in Switzerland. The museum there is astounding. It's one of the best theatrical museums I've ever been to. It's
wow,
beautiful. You cry. There were moments in there when I was watching. They had it's big. They have got Madame Tussauds quality statues there of Chaplin through different time periods, and you can walk up and put your arm around him.
And
it's unbelievable.
Selfies.
Helps you. It's just, yeah. And yeah, it's beautiful. But no, I haven't met any members of the family. But I know a number of people who have. But my interest really is of that man on the screen.
Right.
That's the man I admire. So,
and the museum you said was in Switzerland? Where, in Zurich or where?
Yeah, it's in where he retired to. Versailles, I think you'll have to look it up. I could be wrong.
Okay.
It's just, It's his house. They've turned that into part museum. You can walk through some of it, but then there's a large building they've built. I look it up for the pictures. It's astounding.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah. Even the beginning of it is really magical too. When you go there, I won't spoil what happens, but they show some films, and suddenly you're in the film, and it's just like,
wow,
you're walking into a set that looks like, you know, one of the Chaplin sets. Beautiful.
I hope that I can see that one day.
Yeah. Oh, you should. It's just there was a moment in there where there was a number of screens in a row playing the same sequence.
Uh-huh.
from an early film where he's making a cocktail. And I'd seen it before, of course, but watching it there in that moment, I went, wow, he's 27 years old and he knows everything. You really are watching a master at work. Just goosebumps when I saw it. I just went, God.
Yeah, and knowing what a career he was going to have in front of him. Yeah.
But you know, is that all that energy from that time in your country as well coming together in the early teens and 20s in the 20th century? An amazing time of industry and progress.
Another person that I believe that you had met when that was Queen Elizabeth. Is that right?
Oh, yes. Yes, yes.
What was that like? I mean, was it a little bit nervous performing for her and then going through the line, or tell me something about that?
No, it was really weird. It was when my hand shadows went viral, I guess, when those things were still possible on the internet early on. It sort of went around the world in about a week. I was actually at Magic Live in Vegas, and I went to check my emails. I hadn't been there for a few days, and there were all these emails from your country first. It sort of progressed its way around the world, the clip, because it was under, I think it was just over a megabyte, and people were sending it via email in those days. This is 2007, I think. And I literally got back to Australia, and within 4 days, I was booked on The Late Show of it going up on the internet. In New York with Letterman. I got back to Australia and I was invitation for the Royal Variety Performance in the UK. And they said, oh, we're late in the day asking you. I hope you can come. Are you kidding? Get out of my way. it was really nice because I could do the shadows really well, what I thought was really well then. Although I recently saw that performance on tape, online, and I thought it was somebody else doing the hand shadows because I didn't think they were very good.
Oh, because you advanced since then.
Yeah. So the end story is you do the performance, and it was in Liverpool, the Empire Theatre, which was an old musical variety theatre, beautiful. And you have to, when you finish your act, you bow to the audience and you turn and you bow to the box where wherever the member of royalty is sitting. You can't see anything. And then at the end of the show, you all line up. Oh, the other good thing that happened on that show was Bon Jovi were on as well. And at the end of the show, we all sang Let It Be on stage in Liverpool.
Mm.
I thought, wow, I really loved the Beatles when I was younger, so that's pretty. And then you stand the line and the Queen comes along and she shakes your hand. And she was really small. I thought, really quite small. And then she just said, oh, very entertaining. And then she moved off. And then the Duke was behind her and he said, best song of the night. And I said, I didn't even sing it. He said, I know. And walked off and then paid out Simon Cowell, from what I heard, which he was renowned for doing. But for me, it was interesting because Wayne Dobson is a big influence and a big, I admire him greatly. And he had done the Royal Variety Performance. And I was just delighted that I could say, well, Wayne did one and I got to do one as well. And it was interesting because it's something I never considered I'd ever do, you know.
Now, when you lined up and she came through and shook everyone's hands, were you on the stage after the rest of the audience had left or?
No, I think the audience was still there. I think the audience was still there. And then about 2 months later, I was doing a job in London and the choreographer had booked me for that. And he said, "What about you? You got a standing ovation from Her Majesty." And I went, "Oh, I didn't know because you can't see anything."
And she's so short.
And she's so short, she probably went like that.
Couldn't tell if she was standing or not, right?
Over the box. She was tiny. I'm short.
Yeah.
I'm short. But, yeah, amazing moment.
Wow. Great. And I know working with the Illusionists had to be fun. Did you tour with them outside of Australia or mainly just within the...
No, I did I did a European tour. I did a tour of the States. And I did Broadway as well with them.
I heard the Broadway show was just phenomenal.
Yeah, it was an amazing time. Jeff Hobson was the MC,
mm-hmm.
and he was incredible to watch. Every show he won. You know, mm-hmm. I can't say that I won every show, but he won every show.
He can handle an audience out of the palm of his hand easily.
Master.
He converts them.
Yes. And he was a really nice man to me. You know, I was having a little bit of difficulty in one of the routines, just with the structure of the show. And Jeff was really, really great. Just going, "Oh, maybe you could do that." And, you know, so
he's a good magician, certainly as well, and could give some good advice, I would imagine.
Oh, yeah. And again, he loves variety acts. So mm-hmm. we would spend a lot of time watching videos of old entertainers.
Right.
Doing amazing acts.
You mentioned David Letterman a little bit earlier, and I know that I guess Steve Martin was on the same night that you were as well. You had done that before you did the Royal Variety Show. So in meeting David Letterman and doing that, I don't recall that he invited you to come over and sit at the chair. I think he just kind of said, "Thanks," and you left.
Yeah, it was at the end of the show. Mm. They put me on last. They were really nice to me, actually. I'd heard different things about Letterman, but I don't. What do I care? I'm just coming to do my shadows. And the guy who had booked me, the talent guy, had set it up that I would run into Steve Martin as he came off, which was I said, "Oh, wow, I just met Steve Martin." He said, "I know, I arranged that he would run into you." And so they were really nice to me. And Letterman came over, and they said he won't come over.
Hmm.
He'll either stay at the desk if he doesn't like you. So he came over and that, and that was really nice.
That he did get up and come over to you, you're saying?
Yeah, he came over.
Yeah.
Yeah. We paid how much for that?
Well,
I don't know what he said.
Well, as far as the shadows go, was that something that you picked up then later in life? I mean, a lot of times I know there are shadow books that kids learn, like when they're prepubescent, it seems like. And you weren't involved with that so much in your early childhood, were you?
No, I used to. The only books I could get on magic were in the State Library here in Adelaide, and they were all like amateur magician's handbook. Mm. And things of that nature. They're all antique books, really. And they all had hand shadows in them. And I'd always thought, oh, that would be... I'd never seen a hand shadow artist at that point. And then I was in Tasmania doing a support act for another magic show, a wonderful magician who would perform here, illusionist called Ross Skiffington. And I used to go visit this amateur magician up the road and talk to him. And I told him about... I thought hand shadows were good. And then when I left... in my pigeonhole, there was the Nicola book on hand shadows.
Mm.
And so I started playing with those. And I used to use a early version of Paper Moon from the 1920s. Say, "It's only a paper moon," when I was doing school shows. Mm-hmm. But it never really made any sense to the children. I just really liked the song. And there was a chap in Australia called Steve Walker.
I remember Steve. He's since passed, but he was a nice guy. Very nice guy.
Yeah, he was great.
He was a good MC, as I recall, too.
Very good. Very funny. Very funny man. Mm-hmm. And he lived in Sydney. I live in Adelaide. That's like two states away. And out of the blue, I got a VHS tape. He sat down because he used to get all the variety shows from England sent over to him on videotape mm-hmm. in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And he sat down and he put together 3 hours of variety acts. I had no idea how long that took him to dub those over. You can imagine going through shows. Right. And on there was a wonderful Indian shadowgrapher. And that was the first time I saw hand shadows move. And I realized that, they're puppets. They're not just shapes. And because I'd done some puppetry as well as the mime technique, I found them a natural fit. I found them. But I just started playing. Then somebody suggested using What a Wonderful World, a doctor friend of mine. And I thought, at that point when I started, it was such a corny song. People were using it for everything but What a Wonderful World. And then by the time it ended up on the internet, I'd been doing it for a number of years. Mm-hmm. So it had evolved enough. But the only original hand shadow in that act is the baby's hand, the little baby's yes. hand that comes down. Mm-hmm. And that's my little son's hand. That's what I think of when I do that, is when he was a little baby.
Right.
But the rest from those old books, really.
I know there are a few other shadowography artists. Do you exchange tricks between shadowographers the way the magicians do card tricks and things?
Well, here's the thing, Scott. I don't watch other shadowographers. Oh. Hmm. My thought was I didn't want to be a shadowographer. I just wanted to see if I could do
sure.
it. You see. And although I've done other pieces with shadows, it's The Wonderful World is what I still get booked for. So I don't consider myself a shadowographer as such. Mm-hmm. But looking at a lot of other people's acts, I'm now pretty good at what I do.
I think so. You're brilliant.
Yeah, but it's because I've been doing it a long time and I've been able to I started cutting silhouettes, because in those old Vernon books we know, right. The books we see the silhouettes and that, and I thought I'd give that a go. And I found that greatly improved my hand shadows, because that gave me a sense of proportion.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to be influenced by anybody else. It sounds silly, but I don't want to see somebody else's shadows and go, oh, gee, I could do that bit.
But I wonder if sometimes there are other shadowographers who may watch your act and say, hey, he's doing my thing, or, I do that rabbit or whatever it is. And even though that is something you've developed on your own, I mean, it's like comedians, I think, that has a joke and then appears in someone else's routine. They say, hey, that you must have stolen that from me. Well, no, it was just independently come up with.
Well, the shadows are all basic shapes, and they're all in those old books. If you know your history of magic, you will find them.
Mm-hmm.
And so the secret is, what are you going to do with them? It's the same as like making a coin vanish. Well, that's okay, but how is your what is it that you want to say with it? What is it that you want people to feel? And my mind teacher always said, be human. She said, if you're human, you can work anywhere in the world. If you're just, as she called it, blah blah, which I think meant to sort of like not shallow, but a flash act might be a way to describe it. I'm not sure. And so when I finally did the shadows, it was the first time that I really felt something. And I have not been able to really find that in my magic, because with the hand shadows, I get to watch it every time. And I try every time I get to see those shapes. Whereas with magic, you're hoping that your angles are correct and you're hoping what they see.
Oh, I see the difference.
You've done your
yes.
homework.
You can see it the way the audience sees it.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I was thinking also about the Chinese acts that are shadow acts as well. And I have seen those where they have cutouts like of a dragon or a lady or whatever in a dress, and they would be on sticks and they kind of move around behind the scenes or something. That's a whole different kind of shadow act than what you're doing with your hands, of course.
Yes.
And when you're talking also about adding those, that's the kind of thing that you add in when you have a little cutout, I assume, to interact with your hand?
Yes, you can. I used to be against that. I thought that was kind of like cheating when I saw it in the old books. But I realized why you do it, because if a shadow person's doing a program and they might have done a 10-minute act or whatever it was in vaudeville, they need to fill that time.
Yes.
And so I've got the name, Mr. Prasanna Rao. I think, and I hope Charlie Fry worked with him. I hope I've said that correctly. And he was the master. Hmm. And if you could find him, you'll say, oh, that's very similar to Raymond's there. Well, it's because that's the man I saw. He was a master. He passed away, unfortunately, but he made the shadows live. And a lot of people, when I see them, because in the books, when you see that, they're just static images.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right?
They don't really. Some of the books will say, you know, you have to impart the feeling of the animal, but many of them just will. I don't consider myself a shadowgrapher, because shadowgraphers, they do hundreds of shadows. You know, they're masters with their hands. I do what I can do. But a lot of them, I find the shadows dead when they do it. I don't see them as living animals.
Hmm.
And I think that's one thing that I try to impart with the animals, is some movement. They may not move exactly as those animals move, but at least I feel that they're living in some
way. Or an animal, or a rabbit might scratch behind its ear or something like that, you mean?
Yeah, and just isolating the different parts of the shadow to move, so that it doesn't move as one lump. The head moves independently of the body, just mm-hmm. as what happens in nature.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, and I've seen, yeah, and so a lot of the, I saw a lot of a different acts over the years, just because people send me their tapes, and now I say, oh, they say, would you like to see my act? I say, well, look, I'd rather you keep it to yourself, because I don't want to be influenced. But many I'd seen from a number of years ago, their shadows were quite primitive, and I didn't feel that there was a lot of love in their work. It's like when you watch a magician and it's cold as they perform. I would rather watch somebody like Danny Kaye or something who has some warmth about them and some love of humanity, at least able to project that. And the same with the shadows. A lot of them just end up just being shapes. Here's another shape I can make. Here's another shape I can make. It's like people producing cards. That's great. But what am I supposed to think?
Yeah, after a while.
You're clever. Mm-hmm. Okay, I've got that. You're clever. That's great.
Right.
Now, what's the story now? And it could be just a display of cleverness. That's fine as well. But at least make that decision.
So that's why with the Louis Armstrong and it's a Wonderful World, is emotional.
Yeah, that's one. Yeah.
And what about the using the rights to that, the ASCAP or whatever? Do you have problems like with that getting taken off of YouTube?
No. Oh, it did get taken off. I never posted it on YouTube, so I'm sure people have made a lot of money as they do. And now it's getting more and more. People are now retaking people's work and then commenting on it or something like this to make money off their work. I just find it bizarre. It's a bizarre world. No, what happened was if I perform on TV or in a theatre, if it's on television, then that television station is responsible for the rights to get permission, pay the necessary fees. When we perform it in a theatre, we pay the, we call it APRA, which is the same as what you were saying. The rights, you pay a percentage of the income from the show goes towards whatever music you've used. But what did happen, one of the nicest things that happened, there were many nice things that happened with The Shadows, was the chap who co-wrote it, Mr. Weiss, was still alive in New York, and he sent me the sheet music with Louis Armstrong on the cover to the world's most wonderful puppeteer. And I had people who worked with Louis Armstrong write to me and say he would have loved it.
Wow.
And that, wow.
Greatest compliment.
Because I never intended, yeah, for me, the initial shape is not necessarily Louis Armstrong that I do. But the beautiful thing about shadows, and that's is that people see what they want to see in them.
Mm.
I found when I first started and I wasn't that good, I used to get more reaction from the shadows than I do now. And I think it's a bit, and Tommy Wonder talked about this, the less you show, the more they see. Mm-hmm. Covered magic, for example. Mm-hmm. He talks about covered magic. Covering your hand with a silk, and we see the silk moving. you have to start using your imagination. What is that? And the same with the shadows. The reason they work and why mime, illusionary mime works is because the spectator has to become actively involved working out what's happening.
Right.
And when they see it, so when people see the rabbit or they see the invisible wall, their mind gets a little reward. And now they've activated their imagination. Whereas if you spell everything out for somebody, there's nothing left.
Hmm.
If you think about Hitchcock, you know, it's the handle of the door turning.
Yes.
Is more frightening than seeing the grotesque creature coming through.
Good point.
Or whatever that might be.
Good point.
And I think that's something magic. You see performers do it in magic. Some people are very good at that. But it's the fashion of fast visual magic. That's great. But I think it's a bit like being hit on the head. You know, eventually, it doesn't hurt anymore. Same with if everything's flash, 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 flash. It's astounding, but it seems less special each time it happens.
Right,
to the spectator.
That makes sense.
A bit. So, yeah. So I think maybe. And I don't always. I'm not always capable of doing what I'm. Don't always do what I'm hoping. What I'm saying, but I really believe that. Covered magic is something that still works. It works very well. Don't spell everything out to you. Probably maybe why mentalism works too, I guess. People have to imagine more. I don't know. But I think people like to play.
That makes sense. That's why abstract art is enjoyed by so many people, because it's what you see in that picture, you know?
Yeah, your mind has to make a decision about
right.
it. Or what does it make you feel?
Right.
And much more interesting, if you think about it, a shape forming under a cloth, for example, just as that example.
Right.
What is that thing?
Mm-hmm.
What is
There's
it?
A mystery.
And so, yeah, it's a what's in the box
yeah.
idea, you know?
Good point.
It's a very strong thing, very underused, and it's just not fashionable, I guess.
I remember seeing an act, I believe, of yours with the pool balls, the pool cues.
Oh, yes, yes.
Do you still do that act?
No, I
loved
put
that.
Together the act, the Eight Ball Tango.
Yes, music was great.
Because, yeah, my friend Stuart wrote that. In fact, he found the angle on it. I'd commissioned him to write the music, and we went to a pool hall and we recorded all the noises of the pool balls, mm-hmm. you know, getting hit. And I thought, oh, it's going to be really cool. And then I was running around doing shows. Me and I rang him up and I said, oh, how's it going? He said, they sound like castanets. I think I'm going to go with the Spanish theme. And I went, oh, that doesn't sound very cool.
But then I
was wise enough to go, let him go for it. He's a very good musician and had a good sense of humor. And really, if you think about traditional booyah balls, you have to stand to the side like a flamingo dancer mm-hmm. or like a tape. And that's really what he found, and it sort of justified those strange positions you have to be in with your hands full profile on the side.
Yeah.
But it was a great project to put together, and I put it together because I was finding I was doing less and less sleight of hand at that time. But in Australia, the venues I was working were not proscenium arch. We don't have variety shows the same as you do mm-hmm. in your country or in you. So. I never really got to perform it.
It's
very often in Australia.
Too bad. I thought maybe you had that as a competition act or something.
I did do it at FISM in Dresden, but at the same time, I found out that I was going to be on World's Greatest Magic, thanks to Peter Raveen, mm-hmm. actually. Peter was always a great supporter of Australians, and I didn't develop it as a competition act. I developed it just because something I felt I had to do.
Yeah. To try to get back into the manipulation and everything. That's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And make sense of it. Make sense of it. Turn those balls back into billiard balls.
Sure.
And in fact, when I did the World's Greatest Magic, because that was recorded in Las Vegas, the balls I was using then were wooden balls that I bought for 60 cents each. And the shell I cast from fiberglass. So the whole set probably cost me about $10.
Hmm.
And I was performing. Rick Thomas was on the same show, a young Rick Thomas. And he had like six dancing girls in this giant illusion. And I felt like the poor cousin.
With $10 worth of billiard balls.
$10 worth of billiard balls. And I remember this chap coming up to me saying, oh, what type of balls are you using? Are they, you know, fakini? And I'd never seen a fakini set. And,
okay.
And I said,
funny.
Oh, no, they're 60-cent balls that I made myself. He sort of looked at them in disgust and walked off. And the show was never shown in Australia for quite some time. And they forgot to send me a tape of the recording. Mm-hmm. And I was quite, it wasn't a routine I was doing regular. And I got quite intimidated when I was there seeing all these amazing, they were all going, oh, where are you going next? Oh, I'm going off to Europe to work in somewhere and something else. And where are you going? I'm going back to Adelaide. Do a school show on Monday, yeah. I think. But when I did see it finally back about a year or a year and a half later before I saw it, I was very pleased the way they'd edited it. And now when I look at it, I'm quite proud of it.
I thought it looked great and the music was great. I was trying to find that music someplace just to listen to that during the daytime. Whenever I'm on the computer, I just think that there are certain songs that I like to hear. And I thought about that from time to time. It's just, I like the rhythm and the way that sounds, but apparently you're saying it was custom made for you. It's not commercially available.
And that's what was great, because when I got to the show, a lot of people had their music changed because of copyright.
You didn't have to worry about that anywhere you go.
No, they could. And so it's still, and that's what happens sometimes with the illusionists, were that they wouldn't, because obviously it's a money-making machine, they don't want to pay copyright on that music. So with my jacket routine, instead of using the song Sway, they had a sound-alike written, beautifully written, all orchestrated, but it never had the same impact. Mm. Because they lost a layer of parody on it.
Yes.
So that's always a danger. So, and also there's another great example with the music. If I hadn't got somebody else to come in and add their input with the music, I would never have had that routine and I would never have been on that TV show.
Yeah. Ripple effects. You never know what one thing is going to cause something else to happen on down the road. Yeah.
Be brave enough to bring somebody else in, you know, and listen to them, a magician. My friend Stuart Day, who wrote the music, isn't a magician, but he had been an actor and a great sense of humor and a great knowledge of music. And that combination, and he really wrote it like a to the video that I'd given him. So he Mickey Mouse the action, if you like, is what I think what they call it with the music. Yeah.
Wow.
So get out there, find those people that can input into your work, you know, and make it grander, make it bigger.
And take your act to the next level. Exactly.
Yeah. It may take it somewhere else.
I appreciate the time that you've given us here, early in the morning over there for you and later in the day for me, as we're so far apart in our different time zones. So the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word Podcast. So I always like to close by asking my guests what it is that's important to you. What is your philosophy of life? It's not necessarily a word, but it can be a phrase.
The biggest advice ever is be human. Just be human. Mm-hmm. Just be a human being. You know, I'd rather watch a human being on stage than somebody playing a character.
Okay.
be yourself. It's a hard thing to realize that you're enough.
Yep. And no one is a better you than you.
Mm. Although I have seen some that are.
Okay. That makes sense too. Raymond, thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
So for the Magic Word Podcast, that was Raymond Crow. This is Scotty out. Thank you very much, Raymond, for being my guest this week on the Magic Word Podcast. I enjoyed our chat, and I look forward to our next one, wherever that might be in the world. I also want to thank all of you listeners for reaching out and telling us how much you enjoy these podcasts. Thank you very much for giving your 5-star reviews and comments on iTunes. So if you have not yet done that, I would certainly appreciate it, which will help our podcast to grow. And you can also join our pod letter if you just go to themagicwordpodcast.com. There you should see a pop-up up that will say, join our pod letter, and that way that we can let you know who's going to be on from week to week, who's coming up in future weeks, and also some suggestions from the archives. This particular week, for an example, we had suggested something from the archives that was back from 2012 when I got together with some of the illusionists back then, which included Aaron Crow, Jeff Hobson, Adam Trent, David Williamson, and Kevin James, and Antonios Hoyos. We just had a great chat, and it's kind of interesting to go back and hear that funny episode that we talk about back then. And so anyhow, that was the type of thing that we suggest from the archives from time to time. So please join us on the pod letter. Just subscribe, and we send you just a weekly newsletter, or what I call a pod letter. And also, if you have the financial ability to assist us, we would greatly appreciate your financial support through your monthly pledges or your occasional donations by using patreon.com or by using PayPal. Next week, we're going to be traveling to Buffalo, New York, where we're going to give you some daily reports from the original close-up convention, the 4F, that's Fechter's Finger Flicking Frolic, and that's going to be the 51st edition, and so we're kicking off another 50 years. We just completed the 50th last year, and so this is going to be, again, another epic one, and I'll be giving you daily reports and talking with several people who are at the convention who are attending from around the world. I know that promise to be fun and one I always look forward to, and I think many of you listeners like to hear as well. So come back and join us next week. And until next week, stay well, get booked, and remember that it's a hard thing to realize that you're enough. So just be human. This is Scotty out.